Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Chris Morgan and Ricky Addington.
Knitting in the craft world.
I know nothing of Eldar.
We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. This is episode 211. If you're joining us on YouTube, we're going to cover Eldar today. Codex Eldar. You're hearing this on the first day you can pre-order Codex Eldar.
Yeah, in case all of the, you know, the Warhammer community hints weren't a build-up enough, now it's here.
I think people know by time, if there's a Codex coming up, you're going to hear the FTN episode on Saturdays.
Yep, that's pretty cool, really.
It's amazing.
Extra insight.
I'm so happy that we can be part of the kind of media blitz for this kind of stuff. And of course they have, like, check out all the craft world rules and the things that they've been releasing on the Warhammer community site. That is going to be kind of your hype source leading up to this, but we get to kind of get our hands on and down and dirty with some of the nitty gritty of stuff.
Yeah, we had to poke our hands on sharp ears.
Yeah. Pointy. Is that weird?
Right. Point taken.
Oh my goodness. I'm leaving this in the show. People need to be exposed to this.
It never ends.
My only regret is that Andrew's not here for me to hear his groan.
My real question though is, by acknowledging them, are we encouraging you? Or should we just ignore them and pretend that it didn't happen?
I can speak from experience the fact that they have not stopped, even when I have, like, completely ignored them and moved on. Like, operators did not exist to give a clean cut with the edit, you know?
I admire the dedication to the cause, I guess we'll just let it run.
It has been relentless and consistent.
I aim to please.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's what you need. I mean, that's what you need.
I've never seen anything else in the show capable of just stopping a train of thought as quickly, though, as Chris's puns. Like, we will be right in it. You'll be like, oh, yeah, this and this and this and this. And then Chris says something, and then it's just like crickets chirping in the background.
Like a record.
And then we have to 3 seconds, wait for everybody to get the obligatory explanation from somebody who's like, got it, right.
Okay, and Warhammer. Chris.
Well, that's staying in the show. We'll see. It all comes together. Let's let the record state that there are long pauses in between some.
One day we got to leave them in. One day we'll just leave them in and we'll call it the Chris Morgan special.
We'll do it. Well, okay. This episode we are going to talk about the Eldar Codex, and I've done a little bit of, I guess, comparison between the points between the Codex and the Index, and there's a lot of stuff that went down in points. And when we talk about this, I think it's important to kind of get an idea of, while some things went down 3 points, 4 points, 5 points, 8 points, the percentage of points that they went down is dramatic.
Yeah, that context is especially useful especially for people who are coming from I hated Eldar in the last two editions, so I don't even want to know anything about them. It's good to get this context.
Well, the Index, I mean, let me talk about just the stuff in the Index. Like, does anyone know what a Tau is right now?
Ain't seen them. I have not seen them since 8th edition came out.
Anybody seen a Space Wolf? Are they on the endangered species list?
I did hear that their natural habitat recently got ruined by some aggressive expansions.
From the warp, is that what you're saying?
Something like that. Something about silver and towers.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is, like, things like Tau and Space Wolves and Eldar, you know, were things that were, you know, very ubiquitous, very propagated throughout the last edition. We haven't seen them, and that had a lot to do with their point efficiency. And so things going down like they have in this new Codex, I think, is going to bring a lot more Eldar back to the table.
Yeah, for me, they never really left. There's still quite a few around here. I've seen so many Dark Reapers lately. There's been so many Dark Reapers around here, as well as the Hemlock Wraith Fighters. Just the combo of the two of them has been a devastating full estate of firepower.
The Dark Reapers, they have the ability to always hit on a certain number. So
and they are they are the bane of things that we talk about on the show, like the Calexis Assassins, where it's, you know, in the FAQs, it specifically says, no, this always hits on threes, supersedes that always gets hit on sixes.
Yeah, and that is state. So the Dark Reapers themselves are still a very potent force, but most of the other things, like even the Hemlock Wraithfighter you just talked about, went down by 11 points.
Oof. I'm tensing up a little bit, guys.
And things like the D cannon went down by 5 points.
I can already hear the groanings.
Well, okay. I mean, it's important. The distortion canon, well, that's what it is. That's what used to be called the distort canon. Now it's just been short to the D canon. It's a 24-inch weapon. It's heavy D3, strength 12. That's very important. Not a lot of weapons have the kind of the profile above 10 on their like main stat. I know there are a lot of times 2 weapons or whatever, but this is a strength 12, negative 4 AP, D6 damage weapon.
And this is the Wraith Knight version, isn't it?
Or no, that's just the regular Vol's Wrath cannon. That's the platform weapon.
For some reason, I thought they were 12-inch range in the last on the Wraith Guard.
The Wraith Guard have a Wraith cannon that is 12 inches. That is assault 1, strength 10, negative 4, D6 weapon. That's the Wraith cannon. That is not. It's not the D cannon. It's the Wraith cannon.
So we're talking about and so we're talking about the distort cannon that's on the
weapons
Wrath
on the weapons battery.
So yeah, D cannons 5 points cheaper. You guys ready for this? How about in general? I mean, you were talking about points decreases, and I'm a big fan of the Wraith units just in general. I've always had kind of a Yandan fix. I like Eriel. I like his story. I like the whole Pirate King comes back to save the craft world, and I hate Tyranids, and they fought Tyranids, so there's that. How are the Wraith units doing, and the Wraith lords in particular?
They are the same points. All the Wraith, like the base points, are the same. But for things like the Titan Ghostglaive, it went down by 35 points. So the Wraith Lord, sorry, the Wraith Knight is doing a lot better.
That is a big jump. Okay.
How about like the stat increases? I know in the preview on Monday, they were talking about Wraith Guard and Wraith Lords getting a toughness bonus. Is that still the case?
Yeah, toughness 6.
For everybody?
Toughness 6 for the Wraith Guard and the Wraith Blades.
Now, for people who don't remember, Wraith Guard have always been T6, and the Wraith Lords have always been T8, up until the Index came out. So
that is correct, yeah.
Them getting the bump back up, I mean, that's going to make a
Lord
big difference.
Wraith Lord being T8 right now also, yeah.
Yep.
With 10 wounds.
That's good. Is he a character? He wouldn't be a character.
He is not a character, but he does have 4 attacks.
That's not awful. I wouldn't say no to it.
3+ armor save with T8, 10 wounds, 4 attacks.
Yeah, that's super good. And especially for the Wraith Guard, like going up to T6, for a lot of models, it's not going to affect your wounding on them with your strength 4 weapons. But for all of you with like strength 3 guns, that now all of a sudden you're wounding on 6s instead, a la Guard, you know, las guns and things like that. Like that's a real subtle balance change that because of the way that it works, all of a sudden your elite units, if you're bringing these Wraith Guard, are a ton more survivable against those what you be scared of in mass numbers like las guns and things like that.
Well, with the Wraith Guard, I mean, this is the same rule from the Index. They have the implacable rule, which means the unit can fall back and still shoot the turn that it does so. Now, we know that flyers can do that, but this is a foot-based unit that can do the same thing now. I mean, it could do it in the Index, but I think that with having the 3 wounds, the increased toughness, that's going to come into play a lot more often with their D size and their Wraith cannons.
Yeah, 3 wounds is big too, for sure, because they used to be 2.
They were 1 in the previous edition.
Well, they were 1 wound back in 7th?
Yeah, 1 wound, I believe.
Oh, man. For some reason, I thought they were 2. Yeah, 3 is fantastic.
They had the high toughness and then a good armor save, but if you got through, they were just gone.
Yep. Very cool.
Yeah, I mean, but with the additional toughness and the ability to fall back and shoot for a foot-based unit, I think we're going to see some of them maybe coming out in Wave Serpents.
Now, how about D-Scythes? How are they doing? Have they changed from the Index?
No, they have not. D size, it's assault. It's an 8-inch weapon, assault D3, strength 10, negative 4 AP, 1 damage, but it automatically hits the target. So with things like Overwatch, so I see them like being able to fall back, shoot, and then when you charge them again, Overwatch, automatically hitting, doing a bunch of damage.
It sounds really obnoxious.
I think I would save my reroll in the shooting phase every turn for that unit, though, because the rule on D size, if you roll a 1 there on your D3, that's kind of brutal. You go anywhere between 5 attacks and 15 attacks for a unit of 5.
Yeah, but that's still a lot of damage putting out, even if they get the 1 on the assault D3, because automatic hits with strength 10.
Yeah.
It's only 1 damage, though.
It's definitely killing Marines quickly.
Well, while we're talking about the Wraith stuff, I want to talk about the Wraith Blades for a minute. The Ghost Axe went down by 5 points.
Wraithblades are always kind of like this cool unit that I never actually saw on the table.
You've never seen it. I don't think you've ever seen them.
Nope.
Great looking models, though. Yeah.
They look real cool, but I've never actually seen someone bring them.
Well, it's because there were D-size everywhere. Why would you... in 7th edition, when you had D-size, why would you take anything else?
You would think someone would take it for the love, Ricky.
The Ghost Axe is one of those weapons that gives you a -1 to hit when you're swinging because it's +2 strength, -3 AP with D3 damage, but it did go down by 5 points. So there's a little bit, if that's what you think you need, you at least have a little bit of relief, maybe a little bit more incentive to take them than you had before.
What's their base strength?
Strength 5 is their base, so they're swinging strength 7 with the ghost axes.
Okay. That's interesting. They were talking about some combos in the Warhammer community article and hitting on 4s, and I think that must be what they were thinking of. I was under the impression they were talking about the D-cannons, or rather the Wraith cannons, but the axes with a -1 to hit, only hitting at strength 7. I'm still kind of on the fence about that.
The ghost swords are +1 strength, and that would give you strength 6, which I think is probably the better buy there.
Now, there's two swords. Do they get a bonus to attacks for having those?
Each time the bearer fights, you add 1 to the one attack.
Okay. How many attacks do they have base? Like 1?
2 base, so not two terrible. Base? Nope.
Okay. So that's like 15... power sword attacks, swinging it, strength 6.
Oh, that's... Do they keep Fires of Wrath in the
they
codex?
They do. Yeah, it's even better because the Fires of Wrath is add 1 to the attack characteristic for the models in this unit in a turn which it charges.
Right. So 20 attacks.
That's not bad at all.
I'll take it.
Throw some of those guys in a Wave Serpent and just be like, all right, here I come.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some Wave Serpents return to the field. Like, they didn't get a change in cost, I don't think, but the weapons that you put on a Wave Serpent did get some changes. I know we're jumping around a bit, but let me go ahead and just jump to the fact that like a twin Star Cannon went down by 32 points.
That is a huge difference.
It's big. I mean, granted, it's only, you know what, 4 shots or whatever with a twin weapon.
Yeah.
Hey, can I stop right here for a second and just ask a question? What was, just because I don't have a lot of Eldar players locally to talk about it with, what was keeping Eldar off the table when the index came out? Was it rules or was it points?
It's points, man. I mean,
it was mostly points.
I mean, they were missing a lot of efficiencies.
Right.
Like, none of the things that worked in the previous edition were going to work with the index.
Got it.
And so there was a model deficit. I guess the model that people had that were playing, and then just the points were really high, in my opinion.
I mean, okay.
So this is going a long way to correcting that, we'll see more of it. Good. Okay.
I mean, at least there's a return on the investment, both from GW's perspective of making new plastic jet bike plastic mold, and the players who bought it.
Yeah. Shuriken Cannon went down by 2 points. You know, I'm a big fan of Shuriken Cannons. And the Scatter Laser went down by 5 points.
Ooh, I have bad memories associated with the Scatter Lasers.
Oh, it's relentless. And now with the Sam Hain ability, I mean, this is on the community site, but the Sam Hain ability, you ignore the -1 to hit when you move.
That's a CM Han for those of us on the north side.
You got a just tomato situation here.
I feel like Sam Hain. I mean, it reminds me of something I saw in a horror movie once, which makes it cool still. But I will admit to you right now, Paul, for like 4 months of you saying that, I had no idea what you were talking about.
Well, several of the craft worlds are named after certain holidays that not everyone respects.
All right. I feel elucidated. Fantastic.
But I think that the craft world abilities, some of them are probably more aggressive than others that play more into like some of, I guess, the traditional play styles. And that's one of them. And it's specifically, in addition, the biker units from the Samhain Wild Host with this attribute do not suffer the penalty to the hit rolls moving and firing heavy weapons.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of counts as Samhain.
I'm going to stay true to my Beltane.
Well, I mean, you do love those shuriken cannons, Paul Murphy.
I do, and they went down by 2 points.
And now you're rerolling ones to hit with them. So isn't that just wonderful?
I guess it's of the craft world abilities. I don't know that that's my favorite, But the way, like, if I can take one step back, I get a lot of questions, or I should say the FTM page gets a lot of questions about, is this X, Y, or ability any good? Is my unit choice any good? And I think a lot of the rules in some of these codexes assume that you need a certain thing to win, like a certain path to victory. Like, is the Death Guard guy that buffs the plague web, the blight grenades any good? He's good if you take a lot of plague marines, if you have a lot of blight grenades.
It's Malignant Booger Lord or something.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right.
Malignant Booger Lord. I'm going to go with that.
It's a hard thing to do, is to evaluate a unit in a vacuum. You know, there's tons of units out there that are good, but if your list isn't taking advantage of that, then who cares? You know, it's...
Yeah, so if you want to play with something, find a way to make it happen and play with it, for sure. That's the questions we get. Is this thing good? It's good if you think your path to victory uses those things that it amplifies. And I do think that the Shuriken Cannon being a little bit less expensive and then getting a buff to do it means that there's value in that trait and the fact that these weapons are easier to acquire and put into a list. And now I know we're only talking about like 5 points here, 5 points there, but I think it's important to really point out that the percentage in which these points dropped is significant across the board, which means you get to have that many more percent of them in your army if you were to focus on them specifically.
Interesting.
So I know we're jumping around, but the craft world traits, the craft world attributes, almost all of them are on the Warhammer community site in the various articles there. So definitely check them out.
Yeah, I love how they do that now, where they're offering up these little teaser in the previews, building up the hype like that. I was very happy. It's almost kind of like rolling the dice to see which one, your favorite one in the lore, if it comes up and how good it is. And I was not disappointed with the ending, though. I will say this now, that it seems very strange that a craft world known for not having lots of people left has one of the best mob rules. In terms of like leadership, they basically get like an Eldar Commissar for free.
Okay, well, how cool is that though? Because this is specifically to benefit the Wraith Host, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it also works for Guardians.
And that sounds really fun for me. I would love to have a big unit of Guardians
or
in the
Dire
back.
Avengers or whatever. I mean, you could take this as far as you want it.
Like a big blob of 20 just as a great screen, and just have the confidence that they would be safe from leadership shenanigans.
Yeah, well, Guardians remain the same point-wise, but Rangers went down by 8 points.
Ooh. Go, Eldar Rangers.
Well, I mean, that's fairly significant. The Ranger, the Eldar Ranger is now 12 points with a unit of 5 to 10. I mean, being a sniper...
Do they still have their enhanced cover shenanigans where they get the +2 when they're in cover?
Eldar Rangers have the Chameleon Cloaks. Your opponent must subtract 1 from hit rolls for ranged weapons that target the unit. In addition, add 2 instead of 1 for saving throws made for models with this unit that are in cover.
So they're getting in cover. They're getting a 3+ armor save. And that sounds, you know, pretty good. That's like a scout with a camel cloak out in the open. But the thing with a scout out in the open or even in cover is that scout is still getting hit on a normal ballistic skill.
Well, you can also set the unit up walking the winding paths of the webway. So you get to basically infiltrate them. So, I mean, they have a lot going on for them and being significantly less point intensive to purchase.
And they're still hitting on threes, right? I think you just said that, but I just want to be sure.
Yeah, and 36-inch weapon that's a sniper.
Yep.
It's a heavy one. It's not a sniper weapon, but it has the rule that says may target characters if they're not the closest.
And it does mortal wounds on rolls of 6.
They're strength 4, but yeah, they do. On a roll of a 6 to wound, they do the additional mortal wound.
You know, having tried snipers for the first time, it's really nice when that comes up. You can't bank on sixes for a strategy, but just having, you know, a bunch of dice rolling and getting, say, 2 mortal wounds on a character that still has to take 2 armor saves plus whatever other wounds you rolled with them, I like it. I feel like Rangers are going to be probably one of the better non-assassin sniper options.
Being 12 points apiece and harder to hit and the ability to deploy differently.
And that's 12 points with the rifles, right?
Was it Eldar Sniper Rifle?
It's the Ranger Long Rifle is what they're called.
The Ranger Long Rifle is 0 points, so yes.
Yeah, I like it.
The Pulse Laser is also 0 points. I think that's a steal.
I'm inclined to agree with you.
Well, let me jump if I can. I know I'm jumping around, but the Falcon went down 49 points.
I gotta wonder about how the math turned out on that. Someone looked at that model and said, you know, 50 points is a little too much. 49. We'll drop it by 49. That's the sweet spot. 48 is too little. 50 is too much. It's got to be 49.
Yeah, the base chassis on a Falcon is 125 points right now. Well, it's down 49 points than it was before.
So that's feels like a great point. Deal. All
that's not. Yeah. I mean, well, let's think about it this way. Like the Plague Burst Hauler is 162 points loaded out. So with the Falcon, with the Pulse Laser and a Shuriken Cannon, you know, whatever, and Twin Link Shuriken Catapults, which, by the way, Twin Link Shuriken Catapults went down by 5 points.
I'm detecting a theme here.
Yeah, most things went down. It'd be easier to list what went up. A Warlock went up by 5 points, but the Warlock Conclave, 2 to 10 Warlocks, is the same price, 30 points apiece.
Interesting. I mean, Falcon's kind of one of those mainstay tanks. You know, it's one of the things that, you know, I don't think we even had Wave Serpents when the Falcon first came out.
The Falcon was one of the first, like, real plastic tank kits ever, and it was amazing when it first came out. I remember, like, I can remember when I created my color scheme of mixing black and green together before there was a Dark Angels green to give me my base coat.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about, is you've got a Falcon. I mean, it used to be in all the starter sets, all of that good stuff, and now it's easier to take. I think that's great.
Well, Pulse Laser, that's the one that comes, it's free, essentially. It's a standard on the tank. You cannot replace that, and a lot of things that you can't replace are 0 points. And it is a 48-inch weapon, heavy 2, strength 8, negative 3 AP, damage 3, not a D3, damage 3 weapon.
And it's free.
Yeah, 0 points.
I think you're paying a little too much for that.
Well, you have to buy the Shuriken Cannon, again, which we said is down 2 points, and a Twin Link Shuriken Catapult, which we said is down 5 points. And so the Falcon was like a trillion points before. It's right now it's down almost 60 points than it was before.
Yeah. No, I think that's good for a 120-ish point model. They can put out that kind of damage just stock.
Well, you're probably looking at 140, 150 points.
120 base, though, yeah?
125 base, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think that's all too crazy.
It's buy two, get one free now, so that's good.
But anytime, right? Anytime you can count on having a 3-damage weapon, just it's so good to just know you can depend on that 3.
You're hitting on a 3+.
Hitting on a 3+. Does it have any kind of move and shoot shenanigans where it ignores ballistic skill penalties or anything like that?
It does not, no.
But, no, like, I mean, Spirit Stones upgrade or anything like that?
Well, that would be something you can upgrade, yeah. But not base, not inherent to
not
it.
Not base. Okay, good. Good to know.
It does have a transport capacity. It did maintain that. It can hold 6 dudes.
I have this fantasy. It's not really a fantasy. I guess you could call it. I have this sci-fi of putting fire dragons in a Falcon, a bunch of them, in a bunch of Falcons.
That used to be what you did.
That used to gut my knights. I have nightmares about that. You might have a sci fantasy there about it. I had nightmares about that because that used to be really good.
Sci fantasy. I like what you did there, Ricky.
The fire dragons and all that stuff remained, I believe, the same point cost.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, which is not bad, but if the support mechanism around them got better and cheaper, that means they're more viable.
Naturally, right.
Cool. Hey, are Striking Scorpions or Howling Banshees any good now? Because those were like the two units that I used to love, but
Striking
they were never
Scorpions
good.
Went down by 4 points each.
Okay.
This is base cost. And the Howling Banshees went down by 2 points each.
Okay.
That's not awful. How about the not the Exarchs, the Phoenix Lords for those guys? I mean, Carandrus had kind of there were some good plays with Carandrus in the past.
Almost all the characters went down in points.
Hmm.
Not everyone. Baharoth, Fuegan, both went down by 10 points. Eldrad went down by 30 points.
Oh, man.
Jayne's Army really went down by 6 points. Carandrus down by 18. Mugen Ra went down by 19. Jayne's Army down by 6. Illic down by 8. Uriel down by 4.
I've got a Mugen Ra that I got from a buddy who was clearing out his Eldar, and I was able to score a lot of metal Aspect Warrior kits from that. All of this Aspect Warrior talk has me curious about how they are, and those are all encouraging numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can make a case for some of those things, especially Mogen Rau, who like always hits on a certain number and buffs things and buffs good things around him, like Dark Reapers. I think you can make a case for him. And the fact that he went down by a pretty decent point cost. I mean, like, let's think of it this way. Like, if you were taking everything, if you're taking Mogen Rau and a bunch of Dark Reapers before, you just got a Twin Link Star Cannon, you know, added to your list.
Yep, that's true.
Which I think is important. Vipers, and this is stuff that's actually pretty interesting. Warwalkers and Vipers got a point reduction. So Warwalkers went down by 11 points, and Vipers went down by 14 points.
So, I love the Warwalker models.
I think they've been effective depending on what their points are. And if the weapons and the weapon housing, i.e. the vehicle, goes down in points, then that's like a recipe. That's what you want to look at to see if you want to include it in your list. Anytime you change the efficiencies, I think that's when you really want to investigate it to whether or not it needs to be included in your list. And we'll talk about Warwalkers here in a second, but Crimson Hunters went down by 23 points and the Crimson Hunter Exarch went down by 48 points.
Oh my gosh.
That's the flyer. That's the flyer thing.
This is like a mattress sale on President's Day or something. It's like, everything's on sale. Come on down. We'll get you a good deal.
So the Warwalkers have the Power Field, which gives them a 5+ invulnerable save. They have Battle Focus, which we can talk about that special rule in a minute. And then you can set this unit up on the enemy flanks instead of placing on the battlefield at the end of any of your movement phases. The unit can join the battle. Set it up so that all models in the unit are within 3 inches of the battlefield edge of your choice and more than 9 inches away from an enemy model.
Can they take those pulse laser thingamajiggers?
No, that's a no.
Yeah, dream, but you said crushed. This was on the Warwalker, is that correct?
Any model may replace any shuriken cannon with any item from the heavy weapons list. And the heavy weapons list is a short list of the missile launcher, bright lance, scatter laser, shuriken cannon, and star cannon.
Which one of those do you think is the best?
That's a hard question. I don't know if I've gone down and really figured things out. But the missile launcher, I've been a big fan of the Eldar missile launcher. And the Eldar missile launcher is remained the same at 25 points apiece.
So if you have three Warwalkers, that's like 150 points in just missile launchers.
Well, you can mix and match the weapons.
That's decisions.
Yeah.
And I don't even own any of this yet.
Chris is getting stressed out over an army he doesn't even own.
A shuriken cannon is 10 points. I mean, so you can get some of this stuff on the cheap.
Well, I look at like the new starter set they've got coming out for Eldar, where it's got like a Farseer, a bunch of Wraithguard, and a Warwalker, and I don't know if it has one more thing. Oh, it has a Wraithlord too. I want to do that fits with what I want to do. And I recently won like a very excellently painted Wraithlord model in a drawing that is done in the Eandon color scheme. So like all of the not hobby time that I have is like tickling at the back of my head. Paint yellow things.
See, I never have that thought. Painting yellow things is a thing that I actively avoid.
But you did that with Hawkshroud.
Well, they were too cool not to, so I bit the bullet on that one. But other than that, I stay away from it.
You see my quandary?
You know what? Challenge yourself. You're not a busy guy at all. So, did the Warwalkers lose the scout vehicle rule, Paul?
They didn't. They get to appear from the table
edge. Right. Yeah, right. So they lost scout vehicle, but they got that.
Yeah. There's no other movement type stuff.
Okay.
I just kind of can imagine them doing that like old cartoon tiptoe thing on their long chicken legs.
They are fast. They are very fast.
And just like, nope, we're sneaking up on you. We're very close.
Yeah, I hope I'm not missing that rule, but I did not see that. I only saw that deployment.
Yeah, I was just kind of looking at that because in the index they had the scout vehicle, and I like that ability to kind of do the same thing that that we do with Sentinels in the Astra Militarum book. So I was just wondering if they had lost that on the Warwalker.
Yeah, so they do have the scout vehicle rule, but it does that. They deploy like I just said.
Right, gotcha. Okay.
Oh, while we're talking about the constructs and stuff, the Wraith Knight is the same points, but the Titanic Ghost Glaive went down by 35 points.
You know, it went on like some kind of ghost diet, slimming down just a bit.
But that weapon does 6 damage apiece, each shot.
Just straight up 6.
Yeah, just 6. Yeah.
Kind of like the Imperial Knight sword of nobody taking.
Automatic discount on that. And the Wraith Knight still gets his ability to his titanic feat.
River dancing. Do you see a reason really to take the sword though, when it can river dance? Like how many base attacks does it have?
Four.
Yeah.
So
you have some incentive if you liked the sword before. Now it's cheaper.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that maybe, like we talked about this before, how with titanic feet, you never, ever really wanted to swing that. You were in very few positions to do that or where you wanted to do that, I should say. But now with it being 35 points cheaper, maybe you end up taking it instead of something like the sun cannon, which is like 100,000 points.
Yeah. The sun cannon had its day back in 6. That was before, you know, Wraith Knights were super heavy and they were obnoxious and all that. But now it just kind of feels really a real stretch to try.
The sun cannon is 118 points.
Goodness.
So I was barely kidding when I said it was 100,000 points.
Plus or minus, you know.
It's the same. It's the same. It's the equivalent of 90 million and a half points.
Yeah, but the counter argument to that is your 90 million points are going to be doing work for you, whereas the Ghost Glaive, all you're really taking that for is to make your Wraith Knight cheaper when you have titanic feet, because 90% of the time, those feet are going to do as much, if not more, work for you.
But that's important, though, because like you do have to buy weapons for it.
Yeah, and I understand. Like if you're going on the cheap, you know, you're trying to squeeze it in there. Okay, yeah, go sclave it up. But me, I like the guns on there better. So you're not wasting.
Do they have the scatter shield or the shimmer shield? Both of them are 20 points. Both of those are 20 points.
It's got the shield. Why does this super heavy have an invulnerable save all the time? That's the official Captain Morgan name. I'm entering it into the library.
Yeah, the Titanic Ghost Glaive is now 30 points. So it's a pretty good decrease in overall points for the Wraith Knight, if you ask me.
Is there a case for something like that that does just straight 6 damage with all of these crazy flying Primarchs around a la Mortarion and Magnus, where you can just depend on, if I hit you with these, you're taking 6 damage?
I absolutely think there is. I think that, like, the knight weapon, I don't agree that you never swing it. I think there's, like, you might not encounter it in the last round of the tournament, but you're going to have to go through a Magnus or a Mortarion or something like, or a knight or something.
Or where, both of them together.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're splitting your attacks, I mean, there, you could conceivably find yourself in a situation to where you're fighting a wounded vehicle or two wounded vehicles, and they have 6 or less wounds apiece left on them, and you want to be able to close them out quick.
Yeah. Well, 6 damage in all cases is better than D6 damage.
A reliable just... I mean, it could be 4 damage as long as you know you can count on it. And I think there's value in that.
Right on.
So we talked about the Warlock Conclave. The Warlocks themselves individually went up 5 points. Along with the Authark Skyrunner went up by 1 point. Now, I know I'm with you on that, Chris. Like, how did they determine that he was 1 point out of whack?
Well, I mean, either that or they're watching a lot of Monty Python. You know, you shall count to 3. 4 is, you know, is right out.
Right out.
Whatever, you know, 5 is right out.
But when riders, jet bikes went down by 1 singular point.
I can just, like, imagine the guy cringing, decreasing that, just knowing that people are going to be like, for every point you decrease these models, hate will be mounted upon you for generations.
I think that some of these decreases, especially in the vehicles, is important. Like I told you that the Crimson Hunter went down by 23 points, the Falcon down by 49, the Night Spinner down by 20.
This whole episode has just been... name the unit and how many points it has went down in points.
But on the theme of madness.
But yeah. This is important though. I mean, if you're
playing with these units before,
or maybe skipped over them in the past, then I mean, these are now more attractive. I mean, this is a slashing of points almost down the whole list of things.
Yeah, it's huge.
Well, I mean, the only reason I'm talking about it, you know, when we joked around about how, you know, what's a Tau? We joked about what's a Space Wolf, because we haven't seen them, because the efficiency just isn't there. This type of point reduction, I mean, it has, how could it not contribute to the efficiency?
Yeah. And then we haven't even talked about psychic powers, relics, stratagems, all these things on top of the new efficiencies. Like, you could almost make a case for, well, it's this many points, but I've got these stratagems, I got psychic power, yada, yada, yada. But we're getting wholesale point reductions, and we're getting goodies on top of that.
Yeah, I think this is going to bring Eldar back to the table, if you ask me. So on that note, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some of the psychic powers and stratagems.
Sounds good.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey everybody, we are back. I said we're going to talk about psychic powers, and I want to talk about the rune disciplines. This is the runes of battle and the runes of fate. And I hope you guys don't mind if I jump right to the warlock powers. They still have the ability to flip them. So you have reversible powers, like for instance, protect and jink. And that's one I want to go to immediately because I think this is very relevant. Protect, choose a friendly Eldari infantry or biker unit within 18 inches of the psyker. Add 1 to the saving throws made for that unit until your next psyche phase. Or jinx, choose an enemy unit within 18 inches of the psyker. Your opponent must subtract 1 from all saving throws made for that unit until your next psyche phase. That's not 1 from armor save. That's all saving throws.
Oh, I'm glad we made rune for this segment, Paul, because that is a very powerful trick.
That's negging invulnerable saves. I know I just said that, but I wanted to call it out specifically to get y'all's reaction. I mean, that's going to come into effect, especially because we know that Eldar weapons have a lot of punch to them. I mean, most of the Eldar weapons are known for having a decent AP to them. So you're going to have a lot of enemies that are relying on their invulnerable save.
And what did you say the range on this ability was?
It's 18 inches.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, especially when you can put it on, you know, like the Warlock Conclave is, you know, kind of a discount, I guess, comparatively to a single Warlock. But there's also Warlock Skyrunners, so on jet bikes.
This could really, and you know, pun intended, spell the doom for some of those really big characters out there, like Magnus, like Mortarion, like Gilliman.
I'm glad that you mentioned the doom, because recently the Yunari and stuff like that came about. There are no Yunari in this book.
Except Eldrad, apparently. I mean, they must have just welcomed him back to Ulthway after gathering Storm 3.
Remember that the battles could take place at any point in time.
Yeah, you say that, but I'm not seeing like any Inari Yvrain as a Dark Eldar character. I'm just saying.
You're probably right. But I think that we're going to see, like, this is one of those things where the index, like, people want to kind of pin some of their army list creation and thoughts on the index. Well, I can just use the index because the community team told me I could use the index. But, like, I don't see anybody wanting to rely on Index Eldar when making their Yunari list when Codex Craftworlds is out. I mean, am I wrong in thinking that creates some type of like conflict?
Well, there's this weird relationship that people have between Index and Codex 40K, especially when it comes to like cherry picking unit profiles.
That's what it is. It is. It's a lot of cherry picking.
Right. You've got the adamant no campers. You know, they're just like, nope, it's one or it's the other. For the most part, in fact, probably entirely, I would consider myself in that camp, you know, for matched play, at least. On the flip side of that, there's the people that want to do the cherry picking. And as a TO, I hate those people. It makes list checking super obnoxious. It's like, all right, do you need to annotate your list? Like, all right, Space Marines, Codex, blah, 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 Codex, Rifleman Dread, Index, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's a pain.
I do think that it is up to the individual organizer of events to make their own rules and decide what they want to do. I mean, and obviously, if you don't have a Codex out or a unit entry out in a current or the most recent published book, then you have to go with the index. That's what it's for. It's to allow you to play with every model that you have. But I really do think that we're barreling towards an environment to where you will not be able to go back and cherry pick anything from those indexes because it's just going to create too much confusion.
Right. And especially where we have stuff like Chapter Approved coming out, where it's going to adjust things that are in the codexes too. Like, which one do you use? Do you use the index? Do you use the codex? Do you use the and which one does the chapter approve work on? It's like, no, just use the most recent published thing and make our lives easier. Anyways, that was a bit of a tangent on my part, so I apologize for that.
I agree. And so let me get back to the psychic powers. I know we kind of went off on a tangent there, but enhance and drain. This is one of the powers on the runes of battle, which is for the warlocks. Enhance is choose a friendly Asari infantry or a Asriani biker unit within 18 inches of the psyker. Add one to the hit rolls in the fight phase made for that unit until your next fight. Psychic phase. And drain is choose an enemy unit within 18 inches of the psyker. Your opponent must subtract one from all hit rolls made for that unit in the fight phase until your next psychic phase. So you're fighting some like berserkers or whatever, you're cutting their threat by what, almost 17%?
Yeah. I mean, almost 17% ish. Approximately.
That's a casting value of 7. So I mean, it's not necessarily always reliable.
Enhance and drain, calf and decaf.
Empower and innervate. The empower is choose a friendly infantry or biker unit within 18 inches. There's a theme, you know, 18 inches is the range band on these runes of battle. Add one to wound rolls in the fight phase for that unit in your next psychic phase. That's big. That's not adding one to their strength. That's adding one to their wound rolls.
I love the plus one to wound rolls when you can actually get it.
The reverse is the reverse of that power is you subtract one attacking the unit from their wound rolls.
Yep.
In the fight phase, specifically the fight phase.
Eldar psychic powers, you're sneaky like that. You're like, well, I only have 2 psychic disciplines, but you kind of have 4.
Oh, I love the reverse powers. I mean, they're being able to flip them, be able to pick 1 or 2 or whatever, you know, get some powers and then get dual use out of it, both in offense and defense, I think is giant. It's a giant boon.
Yeah, well, you're just becoming more versatile, so it's you're twice as good at whatever you're trying to do. Now, my question is, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but I just want to make sure that counts. If you cast either version of that, that counts as casting that spell, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like you couldn't have 2 people casting the both versions of it.
Well, I don't know about that. I think they're 2 distinct powers. So one can cast the empower, one can cast the innervate, which is the reverse.
I do believe you found our first FAQ topic,
Paul. Well, no, because it says in the runes of battle, it says each effect counts as a different psychic power. A warlock conclave that manifest conceal can also attempt to manifest reveal. Ricky Addington.
Boom! They knew I was going to read it. Okay, carry on. Good job, GW. I'm proud of you. Guys.
No, that's good anticipation. I mean, I that would be my call, but it's nice that it's also here supported by the Codex.
There you go.
The runes of fate. This is the Farseer side. So the fortune. Fortune has a warp charge value of 7 and manifests to choose a friendly Asurani unit within 24 inches of the psyker. Until your next psychic phase, whenever that unit suffers a wound on a D6, on a 5+, that wound is ignored. If a unit already has an ability with a similar effect, an example, Ulthway's Foresight of the Damned attribute or the Avatar Arcane's Molten Body ability, then the effect of Fortune replaces the ability until the next psychic phase.
Okay, yeah. That answers my question that I didn't ask.
They're on it with this book. They're just answering everything we didn't know we needed to ask.
There you go. The Will of Asurin, which is used to be like, would they give you automatic rally or something like that, has a warp charge value of 5 and manifested friendly Asurani units automatically pass morale tests while they are within 6 inches of the psyker until your next psychic phase. In addition, you can add 1 to all deny the witch test that you make for the psyker until your next psychic phase.
Now, what's the warp charge on this again?
That's a warp charge value of 5.
5, okay. I feel like there's been a lot of 7s, a lot of higher warp charges.
That was in the Warlocks. I theoretically, they're not as good as psychers, I think, as the Farseers.
Little tryhards.
Executioner is strong. Executioner has a warp charge value of 7. This is for a Farseer power. If manifested, the nearest enemy unit within 18 inches of the psyker suffers D3 mortal wounds. If a model is the target unit is slain as a result of this, the target suffers an additional D3 mortal wounds.
Yeah, that doesn't sound awful at all.
That's if a model in the target unit is slain as a result of this, the target unit suffers an additional D3 mortal wounds.
Yo, so I heard you like smite. So I put some smite in your smite.
You can smite.
So you can smite.
And executioner.
And executioner.
So and you wipe smite a and whole smite marine again. Squad with one psyker.
Can that keep chaining?
I don't think so. I think if a model, it just says if a model in the target unit is slain as a result of this, the target suffers an additional D3 mortal wounds. So I would just say that. I would think that stops it.
Okay. I think so too.
Well, I hope so.
Saying it for the benefit of the people who are really going to try and push the envelope on that. I mean, it's almost like there is no minimum safe distance when it comes to clear wording in GW rule sets. At the same time, I think that it would be a pretty hard sell to tell somebody that you can effectively do the old Blood Talon thing with mortal wounds in 8th edition.
Indeed. And then Mind War works similarly to it has in previous edition, except that they suffer mortal wounds with the difference of the scores. So, yeah. I mean, Farseers are a pretty good mortal wound generation device.
I was looking at that power, and it reminded me of the Grey Knight power that's very similar to that.
Yeah. No, it's a good power. And there, of course, there are other psychic powers that we haven't covered, and we will cover more on next week's show. Do you guys mind if I jump to a couple of stratagems?
Let's do it.
One that jumped out at me is the Starhawk Missile, which is one command point. You can use this stratagem just before an infantry model from your army attacks a unit that can fly with a missile launcher. So it's obviously it's very specific, but you make only a single hit roll with this weapon. However, add one to the hit roll, and if it hits, the target suffers D3 mortal wounds.
Dang.
So okay. It's specific to an infantry model, like a Dark Reaper Exarch or whatever, with an Eldari missile launcher. You add one to the hit roll. Not that you need it with that guy, I don't guess. But if it hits, the target suffers D3 mortal wounds.
I mean, it's almost awful. I mean, it's almost guaranteed. I mean, you got to... What, like a 1 in 6 chance of that? And don't the Dark Reapers reroll hit rolls of 1 anyway? If they've got the Exarch?
If Mung and Rod and Exarch's near him, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're running Dark Reapers, hey, each turn, Exarch, pop off Exarch, right?
You could have this in a Guardian squad. This is something you don't necessarily have to always use, but it's a stratagem that you can act.
But look at how many powerful models have the fly keyword.
Yeah, Demon Princes, Magnus.
Storm Ravens.
Yeah. And back to those things needing sevens, there is a stratagem that's the Seer Council. Use this stratagem if you're in your psychic phase, if a Farseer unit with a craft world, so they have to be, I would assume they have to be the same craft world, is within 6 inches of a friendly warlock unit, you can add one to the result of any psychic test you take for the two units for the rest of the phase. That's all psychic powers for the whole phase.
With those sevens out there, I think that's going to benefit the warlocks a lot more than it's going to benefit the Farseers.
Yeah, I don't mind that, though.
It's going to benefit anyone. I mean, you don't think it's going to benefit you until you play that game and you fail. Like, I saw a Grey Knight player fail 3 smites in a row, and she only needed 4s. So, that's rough. Yeah, I'll take +1 to casting rolls anytime.
This is where I get really excited about the strategy of playing an army with Codex releases in 8th edition, is looking at the stratagems, looking at how many command points you can generate in your army, and weighing the balance of which one is important to use and which one isn't. We've talked about this a couple of times, but I think it bears repeating that I think the best players in 8th edition are going to be the ones that have Codexes that know when to use a stratagem and when not to.
Yeah, and I think having those cards, like we talked about that on the last episode, having just the card, even if you write the notes yourself on index cards, of having that stuff out there in front of you to know it's available, I think is going to help you win games.
For sure.
So we talked about like Eldar being the master of the psychic phase and that kind of stuff. Well, I don't know if we talked about that, but that's kind of what they're rumored to be in the lore and what we expect for them to have. They have a stratagem called Unparalleled Mastery. Use this stratagem when a Farseer successfully manifests their last power in a psychic phase. The Psyker can attempt to manifest an additional psychic power this turn, and that's one command point.
So basically, you can force a proc. All you MMO players just know what I said.
Well, I mean, we just talked about, you know, Mind War and an Executioner in Smite. I mean, I could see you wanting to do a lot of those things.
Yeah. I mean, the Executioner in particular, I'm still just kind of like, whoa, man. Oh, that's kind of intense.
The Eldar have, this is one that I think is worth mentioning, that they have a Webway Strike stratagem. And this is much different than they, it's not much. It is significant enough significantly different enough to speak about it on this show. Use the stratagem during the deployment if you have not used the Cloud Strike stratagem, which I'll mention that here in a second. If you spend one command point, you can set up one infantry or biker unit from your army in the webway instead of placing on the battlefield. If you spend three command points, you can set up two such units in the webway instead. A unit in the webway can emerge at the end of any of your movement phases, you know, set up 9 inches away. But I think it's interesting the fact that you can spend one command point and get one, or three to get two units. That's different than what we've seen in other codexes with similar effects.
Do you think that it's partially due to some of the very powerful killing power of some of their things like Aspect Warriors, or just everything's better in threes, right? You know, 8th edition, like every other edition of 40K, repetitiveness in army, you know, redundancy in army list building has been key to success. Being able to just pop out with three units of fire dragons real close to somebody or whatever, right?
That's a good point. I can see them and phrasing it this way just to be distinctive in their own way, and maybe how it's difficult for craft world Eldar to travel through the webway.
Maybe. And it could just call out to some very faction-specific fine-tuning that wasn't just a copy-paste mentality, that there was some extra thought into it. You know, a man can dream, man can hope.
Yeah, the Cloud Strike is for Eldar vehicles with the fly keyword. If you haven't already used the Webway Strike, then you can set up an Eldar Aserani vehicle unit from your army that can fly in the clouds instead of placing it on the battlefield. It can descend at the end of any of your movement phases, set up 9 inches away. If you use this stratagem on a transport, all units embarked inside remain, so when it is set up in the clouds.
I mean, it wouldn't really make much sense. Like, oh, hey, guys, I'm going to go for a flyby. Will you wait here? It'll be fine. It'll be fine. I'll be back.
Yep. But it's neat that they can take transported units, so they stay in the vehicle.
I'm trying to think of how I would use that one, because most of the Eldar tanks are pretty fast. So, I don't know. I feel like I could probably get there and on turn one. Usually you're going to get close to where you need to be anyway in their tanks, so I don't know if I'd use it as much, but it's a good way to protect a vehicle that you want on the table. You know?
That last thing you just said is very important, because you run into certain things that
Necron pylon is going to come up.
Well, you know, turn one. Progressive missions, the relic, or you know, things like that where you want to drop down on it and do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for late game. I mean, I guess you can, I mean, you'd still have to come in, what, turn three now, but
Turn three, yeah. But, I mean, if you're getting on the relic and stuff, I mean, these are things, everything is situational. It's just worth mentioning the fact that it exists. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about some finishing moves, specifically about things that might come up while you're painting some of your Eldar stuff. But anyway, hold tight.
Sounds good.
Make sure to grab your tickets for the SoCal Open 2017. Occurring in lovely Del Mar, California, October 21st and 22nd, this awesome event features Warhammer 40,000, Age of Sigmar, Infinity, War Machine and Hordes, Drop Fleet and Drop Zone Commander, and so much more.
Hey everybody, we are back. Hope you enjoyed that word from our sponsors. I do want to talk a little bit about the special rules of the army, like as a whole, the Eldar army as a whole, before we get to the finish move segment. And Ancient Doom is the reroll hit rolls in the fight phase versus units of Slaanesh. And you may add one to the morale test for this unit within three inches of a Slaanesh unit. So worse than morale, same as before. Reroll failed hit rolls in the fight phase versus Slaanesh. So there's that. I'm glad that that's consistent. And to me, it feels almost like punitive. Like I'd rather not get the hit roll and also not have the negative morale, but it still makes sense.
Now, would this apply to things like noise marines?
Anything with the Slaanesh keyword.
All right.
Yep. Battle focus. If the unit moves or advances in the movement phase, weapons, and this is the kicker, excluding heavy weapons, are used if the unit had remained stationary.
Now again, that little fine-tuning thing.
It matters. I mean, it all matters, but it's excluding heavy weapons. And then the path of command reroll, hit rolls of one for friendly craft rolled units within 6 inches of a model with the path of command. In addition, if your army is battle forged and this model is your warlord and on the battlefield, roll a d6 for each command point spent when using stratagems. On a 6, that command point is immediately refunded. Note that for Prince Uriel, the first effect of this ability applies specifically to Iandan units.
Yep.
So getting command points back, for each command point spent. So you spend 3 command points, you roll for each one. Yeah, you roll a d6 for each command point spent.
Yep. Oh, and any chance you get to keep some of those that you spend is super powerful. I mean, it's one of the linchpins behind Ultramarine strategies.
Yeah, in the section here before you get to the craft world attributes, it does mention Yunari. It says Yunari is a keyword that some units in this book can gain when taken as part of the Reborn Army, as detailed in other publications.
Mm.
If a detachment includes any Yunari units, it is no longer a craft rolls detachment and will not gain either of the abilities listed below.
So what you're saying is I can take stuff out of this book and use it with my index Yunari, as much as you all hate that.
I do believe they're going to re-release the Triumvirate set.
Yeah.
With the Yunari in it.
With updated rules.
With updated rules. So I'm interested to see how that comes about. There are no Harlequins in this book either. So just take that for what it is. You will get the your troops in the Craftworld detachment gain basically the OBSEC ability if they're Battleforged Army with a specific Craftworld.
Or the not OBSEC, but acts like OBSEC rule.
Yeah. And the Heroes of Legend rule, which this is good. This is important. This is one of those things that you would take for granted, but if it wasn't spelled out in the rules, you'd have complications. And it says the inclusion of a Phoenix Lord in a craft roll detachment does not prevent other units in the detachment from gaining a craft roll attribute. However, Phoenix Lords can never themselves benefit from the craft roll attribute.
They're the commissars of Eldar.
Well, they're
just a bunch of Yeriks running around.
Well, it's all those in the Imperial Guard book, it mentions those list of things that don't violate your army rules, and this is just Phoenix Lords in this case. I mean, it's important. I mean, you would have people that would like to argue such things if it was not spelled out in the Codex.
Yeah.
The finish and move segment I want to talk about today is something we've kind of talked about before, but it's especially important with the Eldar because textures and the mixture of painted surfaces versus non-painted surfaces with things like the cockpits and the little plastic bits that they use, like for Warwalker shields and cockpits on the Wraith Fighters and the Crimson Hunters and that kind of stuff. And even so far as like maybe the face on the Wraith constructs.
Right. Yeah, the kind of glass
it's just a plastic part. It's the same texture as everything else, but there are some people that like to call that surface out as opposed to other things on the model, and especially things like all their weapons. Like there's a lot of power axes and a lot of power swords and stuff like that in an Eldar army. Now, I want to also link this to the rim of your bases, because remember that everything we talk about is all about gaining more points in like a rubric and helping you kind of up your overall appearance score on things.
Sure.
And what you choose to do with these surfaces can have an impact on how a judge scores you. For me, I don't like to paint the glass on the cockpits.
Yeah. Thank you.
But I do like to paint every rim on my base.
Now, painting rims, do you, Paul, I know this was kind of common in 7th where there's a lot of formations and detachments to worry about, and we haven't really had to worry about distinguishing models from maybe the same faction that crossed detachments that benefited from certain rules or another. But in the new 40K, it seems important to have some kind of way of recognizing if you have a mixed detachment, which ones benefit from certain rules from, say, a mono faction detachment, and which ones are more of a Imperial soup or Xeno soup or Chaos soup.
That's a very good question. I want to preface this all by saying that I paint for points. I enjoy painting. I don't feel like I'm the best painter, but I paint to gain me points in the tournament. Again, I enjoy it, and I think my stuff looks good, and I'm always trying to be better. And if you can follow, like, I post a lot of work in progress stuff on Twitter. So, you can be the judge of whether or not you think I'm a decent painter or not. But the heart of it is I started my painting journey to gain more points in tournaments. So take that, as kind of the way to shade everything I talk about from this point on.
Especially considering, Frontline Gaming, sponsor of our Finishing Move segment, where we've been working with them on creating the hobby track. that is going to, much like the competitive angle of the ITC, we're going to be tracking people who deliver on the hobby side, and the hobby requirements for their major events are going up as well, where you need to have finished models with basing done. Like this is very pertinent to that. This conversation is very important to the competitive crowd, that you guys are going to need to be ready to up your game a bit.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that any rubric should never get in the way of an organizer being able to judge what they think is the best painted army at their event. And I don't think any efforts that we're doing on the scoring side is ever going to interfere with that. But it is a consideration, because it's going to determine, you know, what the standard is, what the benchmark is for this type of stuff. At least give you something to aspire to, right? If you especially if you want to go and try to win out at these things, or you want to be the best, you know, faction painter in the world, really, for as far as competitive 40K goes, you're going to have to meet some of these standards. So I think that's what you're talking about. Is that right, Chris?
Yep. No, you summed it up just right. What were you going to say, Ricky?
I was just going to touch back on the painting, the cockpits especially. That's just something that it's always been a pet peeve of mine, where it bothers me. It doesn't bother other people, but it bothers me. So it's there's just two camps to it. The people who will just paint a cockpit black and say, well, it's, you know, it's painted. It's almost like some people don't consider that part of the model. It's always felt like a cop out to me. I'm a big fan of being able to see down in the cockpit and being able to see that you've put that little extra effort into it.
Me too. But there really is a style choice. Like, I think that with anything, you have to be deliberate. Now, you can create a story that justifies your action, whether that's inaction. Maybe you're too lazy to paint the Marines and the buttons inside.
Hey, sometimes, you know, you take your Storm Raven to pimp my ride and they tint the windows for you, you know.
or maybe it's very specific to where that when your eye is crossing across the model, you don't want to have the light to reflect differently off of that surface to distract from some other elements on the model.
That might be the most artistic thing I've ever heard you say, Paul Murphy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, did you black out right there?
I am.
My nose is bleeding.
I am so impressed right now. Like, Paul is not an awful. I played with Paul's models at Adepticon last year. Like, he's not an awful painter, but that is a real aesthetic, artistic consideration that, you know, your college art class is going to really like say, do this, but don't do this unless it works.
Well, that's where I'm at because I don't believe in painting the cockpits. I don't believe in blacking them out or coloring them in a certain surface. I like to see the same thing that Ricky does. I like to see the stuff inside. I like to see maybe some effects, a glowing screen or something, some effort that you've done to paint all those details inside. But the same thing applies to the rim of the base. I mean, sometimes people paint the rim of the base to cover up any like overspill of paint that they may have done of texturing or coloring the actual top of the base, the flat part of the base. But
that's
that bevel,
usually what mine.
Yeah,
that's what I do. Is I go back with black paint. That's every one of them. Yeah.
But the bevel on the base has the same similar reflective properties as a cockpit or any other surface, and it can distract from the overall look of the model, especially if you've got some paint smudges on there. But specifically, we're talking about finishes, and I mean, we talk about textures a lot. This is a texture, but it's about reflection of light more than anything else.
Right.
Yeah, that glossy black, it just looks like black plastic. It, even when you paint something glossy black in the wrong context, it just looks like bare plastic. It's why you don't want to paint an army just kind of gray, typically, unless you know how to do it well, because it looks like you just primed it. So it's kind of the same thing with that glossy black. You definitely don't want to see just gloss black, because everybody knows under that paint or whatever you've done to that base, everyone knows that it's black plastic. So when we see black, like a shiny-ish or, you know, maybe satin black on there, in our heads, we're thinking, oh, well, you know, that's bare plastic.
I don't know if I ever have that problem in particular, but, you know, with me, I used to be very much in the don't put a different color on the rim of your model camp. I used to camp there It was kind of dirty, maybe a little bit sloppy, some dry brush lines here and there. But the reason I did that is I thought, well, it makes the base look less unified. But one of the things at the time that I didn't consider was how distinct and I want to say polished your army can look when you have that the rim of your base, and it doesn't need to be black.
It doesn't have to be black. That's I'm glad you mentioned that. It can be any color you want as long as it looks like you deliberately did it.
And you just see the difference with models that have it done and models that don't have it done. The way that when you set them down on either a display board or on the table themselves or the table itself, there is a noticeable difference in how clean and how much they stand out on the table.
Yeah, I like it, you know, especially like if they've got like a desert theme going or something, bringing that brown or that tan over all the way, it helps it to blend in, especially if you're using a display board, it's going to help blend in. One thing that I will say, I've seen people paint the bases like different colors in order to use it kind of as a squad marking, so they know that that gaggle of 50 termagants is this unit and this one's that one. That takes me out of it, you know, out of the fantasy. From a gameplay standpoint, it's very convenient. And
it's very practical
also, but yeah. It is convenient.
Yeah. It's a very practical consideration.
Yeah, very practical. Yes, it's practical, but I hate seeing it if I'm judging painting, I hate to see it because it takes me away from the fantasy, even though I can't fully, you know, be like, oh, I wish you hadn't done that, because I understand the need for people to do that sometimes, or the desire to do it for convenience of gameplay. I think it does take away from the fantasy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we've talked on this segment quite a few times about squad markings, right? We've talked about the importance that plays in making, you know, getting that one extra hobby point that maybe helps you win the Renaissance man or the best overall.
I mean, it will help you your overall gameplay too, if it's just communication with your opponent. But yeah, this segment is specifically around points.
And this, you know, when it comes to base rings for Xenos armies like Tyranids that don't have, you know, squad markings or something like that. And it can be incredibly tedious to say, all right, well, these 20 termagants, they have a chameleon spotted pattern. And these ones, they have a black forest beetle, you know.
I tried to sell Ricky on the fact that my catechins all had distinct camo patterns. And if he couldn't figure out, it was on him.
Look, that may have been yelled as he's walking out of the building down the steps to go get lunch. And I'm like, where's your squad markings? And he's like, it's on the camo. Figure it out. And that's what was told to me while everyone else went and had tacos and Ricky's sitting there scoring people's armies. So somebody may have not maxed that rubric by a point or two.
Subtle. I think that the rim of the base is one of those places for those armies that you can make something like that work, where it doesn't necessarily have to be like, these are the hot, you know, the hot pink rimmed termagants.
Oh, I don't know if I can
and
get behind
this, man.
These
are the baby blue.
I do think that something on the back of the base just for overall playability, but I think you got to change the eye color or a scale color or something on the model itself to really do that.
There's something you can do for that. I you know, painting a bunch of Infinity models, they like to have the rings of the base reflect the vision of the model itself, because it has an in-game impact. So the rim of the base becomes almost a feature of the model in those instances. I think that having maybe a split, something that matches, you know, of course, from a color theory perspective, you don't want to put two conflicting colors right next to each other. But if you have, like, say, three variations of a similar brown, something that's featured on every base, and you want to distinguish your squads in that kind of a way, it'll look a little different, but it'll all look like it belongs together.
That's solid. I can see where you're going with that. But the main focus of this is about the reflection of light. And I think that with Eldar, between things like all the various gems and stuff like that they have, I think this might be an excuse to kind of break out that gloss varnish on certain elements and have it be okay.
I love me some gloss varnish. I don't play Eldar, but I play typically Marines or something with lenses. And I use gloss varnish, just like you would put on like the spirit stone thingies that you space elf people have. Spirit stones, right? Am I using that right?
You're close. I mean, that okay. is something they have, yes.
I think of them as armor pimples, but, you know, whatever you call them. After you do your model up and, you know, put your I typically just use the anti-shine varnish from the Army Painter. That's kind of one of my go-tos. And that takes pretty much all any gloss, any shine you're going to have. It's going to take it off the model. But then you just get your gloss varnish out and just brush it off.
You can brush on. You want a brush-on version. So that's like the Art Coat from GW. Yeah, almost every painter brand has a brushable gloss varnish.
Yeah, and then you just take that little gloss coat and go back over whatever you've just taken the shine off of that you want shiny, just go right back and put it on there. And it makes a world of difference. You can do that for lenses. You can do it for spirit stones. You can do it for that black cockpit. If you wanted to go back and make it glossy, you could put that on there and it's going to give it, you can do that to make it look wet. You can do that to make it look
like a tyranny tongue. I know we're jumping around with like things, but what we're really talking about is the texture and finish of a model and how to be deliberate when you apply something that's different. Because I mean, I'm a fan of a matte and sometimes satin finish to my models, and that includes all the way down to the rim of the base. Now, but I know that I'm making that choice to not have that because you can't put that on a cockpit piece of glass, something transparent.
And oh Lord, yeah.
I do
good,
not.
Good point there.
Yeah, I don't often gloss my power weapons, but I think with the Eldar, you can really justify a little bit shinier of a texture on some of their elements. But I don't think you want to have that on the rim of the base, and I don't think you want that on the cockpits.
No, only if you were like painting the cockpit and then maybe wanted it to look like, you know, it was reflecting, or actually it make it to reflect some light there. But definitely if you're using clear cockpits and you're going that route, do not glue that thing on and keep it as far away from any sort of varnish or
seal the model first.
Sealer or anything. You're going to seal that model and you are not going to get anywhere near a spray with that clear cockpit, or you're going to ruin a clear cockpit and it's going to look like bathroom glass.
Yeah, but specifically with the Eldar, if you want to go back in and do some deliberate application of a different varnish, I think this is the time to do it.
Yeah. I'm kind of on the fence, though, about the glossy swords. I would have to see it and see what I think about it. But on a whole, when I see gloss coat, most of the time I think glass or wet. So when I think of it on the swords, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, that's a valid point. You don't think glowing. You don't think ceramic or whatever. I don't know what the...
I don't know. What do they make their swords out of? Is it that Wraithbone stuff or is it just...
It would be Wraithbone, I would assume. I think everything they have is out of Wraithbone.
Yeah,
but that so is their armor. So I mean, you bring up a good point.
Just gloss coat everything.
Don't gloss coat everything, or not gloss coat everything.
Oh, it's the worst.
I don't think you should gloss coat the entire model. I think that is going to be tacky. I do think that with Eldar, more than any of the other factions, you can get deliberate with changing the varnish on some aspects, especially the Spirit Stones.
And the Spirit Stones are the prime example of it. Is just those, and that's what makes them stand out so much, though. You know, if the whole model is a satin finish or a matte finish, and then those Spirit Stones are actually catching the light and they look like they're gemstones, it creates that striking contrast that you don't need a ton of extra color on there. You've got texture to help with that.
Well, one of the things just in general, and this can apply to paint, but this can also apply to varnish, is that the eye of the judge, the eye of any viewer, is automatically going to travel along the brightest point. You know, it's going to go from dark to light. So if you have just an oversaturation of shine on your model, that's going to lose you points, and it's going to be distracting instead of beneficial. So you want to be just very careful with your application of it. and make sure that you understand just the way that the eye works.
It's a very good point of understanding how that works. And then understand that even if they are like going down and being particular to a specific rubric, which they should, any tournament that publishes a rubric for point scoring, they should go down without like bias or preference and score appropriately. But this is stuff that the stuff we're talking about now is differentiating you between categories like best, first, second, and third kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the level that we're talking about.
And you can make this mistake even with some, you know, people love their airbrush blending nowadays. Making that shine, the oversaturation can really distract. So just use with caution. Apply sparingly.
I just think use that Eldar is a good place to maybe do a little bit more than you would before. But on that note, let's go ahead and wrap it up. I think next week we'll come back. We'll talk about more about some specific unit entries and some strategies around maybe some Eldar builds that you will see. Anybody else got anything to add before we get out of here?
No, I'm very excited. I'd love to see your first draft of a list next week, Paul. We'll have to brainstorm about it this week.
I think it might be like Wave Serpents, Falcons, and some Wraithguard.
That sounds fun. I would play that.
Might not be bad. All right, guys, we'll see y'all soon.
See you around.
Have a good night.
Thanks for listening.